This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to The Business of Wealth. Today, I have the pleasure of talking innovation with Rafael Febres Cordero, a trusted advisor to entrepreneurs and senior executives at leading financial services organizations. He helps them navigate change, design sustainable growth strategies, and transform their organizations to thrive and grow in a digitally enabled environment. He helps companies institutionalize innovation capabilities through the design of operating models and deployment of broad range of enablers. With over 25 years working in the asset and wealth management industry, Rafael is an accomplished executive with proven track record of profitability, developing and advising asset and wealth management businesses in the Americas, Europe, India, and South Korea. He has led and advised cross-functional teams of senior professionals transform, innovate, build products, and launch new ventures. Rafael served as a senior advisor and executive in residence to financial services organizations at Capgemini's Digital Transformation Division, managing partner to a Boston-based strategy innovation consultancy, partner to a Boston Family Investment Office focused on emerging consumer brands, and a senior advisor to a Boston Venture Capital Fund focused on medical technology. He currently serves as board advisor to a Bogota-based venture studio, building digital platforms to empower the middle class in Latin America, called Polymath Ventures, and a Boston-based real estate fund focused in the commercial space in New England, called North Colony Asset Management. Rafael holds an undergraduate degree in business administration with honors from the Northeast University and a Master of Science in Management from Hull Business School. He's a board advisor of the Global Leaders Program, board visitor at McLean Hospital, and a member of the Concord Holy Family Parish Council. So this is an impressive resume and also a very interesting conversation with Rafael. I hope you enjoy. Rafael, welcome to The Business of Wealth. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're speaking to us from Boston, right?
In fact, from a little town called Concord, northwest of the city of Boston. So this is where the very famous writer who actually alerted the militia. This is at the time when the U.S. was fighting against the British. So I am three miles away from when this battle took place, and the U.S. actually won the independence from the British.
That's true.
So there's a famous writer called Paul Revere, who actually was galloping 3 miles from here, alerting the militia that the British were coming.
That's really cool. Okay, so I'd like to start this interview asking you, what is the best compliment you have ever received?
I have been by my mom, by my parents, that I'm a good son. My children tell me that I'm a good parent. My wife tells me that I'm a good husband. And my dear friends that I count them with the fingers of my hands tell me that I'm a good friend. So
now that you mentioned parents, how would they describe what you do for a living? I like to ask this question because it puts, you know, a career into perspective sometimes, right?
Yes. Given that we culturally come from patterns of cultures similar, Alejandra, my father is no longer with us, so he didn't get a chance to see me professionally. My mom did, and she has seen bits and pieces here and there. So given that I've spent the bulk of my career within the financial services industry, and I had my first financial services job was working for a bank, she's still under the impression that that's what I do. And every time I try to explain, it's very hard. I can see it's very hard for her to grasp anything. So she blocks it right there. She feels comfortable within the confines of banking. So I always tell her, I'm just trying to make the situation better for my clients, whether it's an institutional client or an end consumer. And she's like, well, then that's good. keep up with that.
That's great. What, you know, now talking about financial services, I know you've worked with a lot of asset management firms, wealth management firms. Tell me about one that you admire. What do they do right?
So let me just break it down in two, because they, when you look at the asset and wealth management industry, sometimes people talk about those two industries as one. And actually, the job of the asset manager is quite different to the job of the wealth manager. The former is about manufacturing, designing innovative investment solutions. The latter is more about how can I help you design a roadmap to fulfill your long-term aspirations as a client. So let me just highlight the ones that I believe are doing a very, very good job. So given that I spent 15 years working for Fidelity, I have my greatest admiration for what they do. And it continues to be a privately held company, held by the Johnson family. Now Abby is at the helm of the organization. But from inception, when Abby's grandfather founded the company and then subsequently her father took the reins to basically take it to where she took it from, and now Fidelity is a global brand. It's an organization that is committed to the job that they're trying to solve for the client. Whether the client is a wealth manager, whether the client is an institutional investor, say a pension fund or a sovereign wealth fund, or whether there is a direct client relationship, which by the way, they do that predominantly here in the US. The one thing that I would say that stands out, and that's why I admire it, is the tenacious commitment to really create something special about the experience with the client, whatever that type of client is. Having been inside the organization for a long time and operating for on behalf of the organization, there's a very, very special focus on the client. So that's one organization that stands out. I mean, there are two more, but I would say Fidelity, in my mind, continues to be a reference in the industry. On the wealth management side, given that you said wealth management, and I'll go back to these after I answer the question. The word wealth management started, you know, more than 200 years ago by Europeans who needed to design better ways to manage their immense wealth. The Pictet family, for example, that created Pictet as a banking charter organization in Switzerland, is one that I believe continues, like Fidelity, continues to be very committed to serving those who have substantial wealth, those who have multi-generational challenges in sustaining the wealth, those who have a global, and the firm continues to be very, very strategically focused in doing that. Obviously, fast forward to today, not only do they actually do a very good job in that, but they have also grown their capabilities to serve the assets of these clients. So they have an asset servicing platform directly targeted to those type of clients. They also created a proprietary asset management organization, not only to serve the needs of their own clients, but they're also offering that to other types of clients. So those are the two organizations, both on the asset management and the wealth management side. One thing that I'll finish here, Alejandra, is the job of a wealth management from inception was to basically do that, meaning you are someone with substantial wealth, you have very complex needs, you need someone who is close, high touch, serving your needs. Fast forward even to today, that is insufficient. And there are plenty of jobs to be done to actually serve the financial, long-term financial needs of individuals, whether you are at the beginning of the wealth building process, all the way to, you know, a typical Pictet client.
That's exactly where my mind was going, because since I met you recently, we spoke a lot about client journeys and client experience. And in both of these firms, you mentioned that that was in some way the focus. Mm-hmm. So who does customer journey right? I have a couple of examples that I love, but I want to hear from you. Who does client experience really right from the get-go and from the roots?
So here, I'm going to deviate a little bit. The financial services industry, by definition, has been, and I'm including banks, insurance companies, and obviously now wealth managers and asset managers. But by and large, you're talking about banks and insurance companies. The sort of the latter two came after the fact, if you will. There's exception with the big techs of the world, but as an industry, the bulk of the industry is basically commercial banks and insurance companies. These are, when you think about the inception of these two types of industries, banking and insurance, they actually have evolved until quite recently, but traditionally evolved from a very product-orientated model, meaning come to me to open a savings account. Then on the back of that, I'm going to lend to you. But then it peripherated to, well, now I can actually give you a different type of loans. I can also give you access to credit that is mobile. This is the concept of the credit card. And what happened along the way is you became a distributor of products, irrespective of what you as a client may actually need. The extreme of these, we saw it with Wells Fargo, where the focus on selling products was so bad that from the top, they created a scheme to actually incentivize people to do fraudulent activities. You know, you, for example, you had different accounts that were open without even you knowing that they were being open for you. So that the people who were selling were actually sort of creating revenue that ultimately drove the stock price higher. So that's the extreme of this model. The same can be true for insurance companies who actually along the way became very aggressive distributors of products to the point that some of these products not only were very opaque, but they were highly priced. You know, people were paying, not until very recently, north of 10, 15%, you know, commissions. So I give you that backdrop to say it is hard for these organizations, and I'm not justifying, I'm explaining, it is hard for these organizations to focus on creating a frictionless experience, an experience that you can actually feel good about and you can go back and you can refer. So this brings me back to the answer to the question. So the fintechs of the world, you can name any of the fintechs. There's one that is very top of mind to me quite recently. It's a newly created bank that now has the national charter as of August 1st to basically provide national services. And the bank is Varo Money. This is a fully digital now national bank that is actually creating a value proposition to serve the underserved. Okay. And the design of the user experience is beautifully executed. The interface is beautifully designed. The capabilities that they have created to engage with a customer, and by the way, it shows. I mean, they already have 2 million customers for such a new organization. And so that is one that really stands out to me. The one additional thing that I will tell you, which goes back to your question, you can actually create a wonderful user interface, user experience with the right products. The products have to deliver the promise. But the other piece to this is why did it take so long until Varo came into market to now say, wait a minute, I don't need to serve the people who are well off for my business model to actually be worthwhile. I can actually do it. And they have done it. They're actually doing it. So that's one that I would say. The other one that is already in the financial services industry, and I'll give you this as a indication of where I think this is going. I don't know if you have an Apple Card.
Yeah, you mentioned them. Actually, I downloaded the Harvard case for Marcus.
Yes.
And learned about it because it's a fascinating case too.
So Apple, very well known for creating an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Right? In fact, when retailers were closing down their basically brick and mortar, Apple, this is Steve Jobs' bet, major bet, he's like, no, how can we actually extend our online presence? If we do a very good job online, why can you actually create a wonderful experience in the stores? So when you think about the user experience on and off, this is another brand that already is in the financial services industry, because they're not tapping Marcus to acquire clients. They have the clients.
Right.
They know who the clients are.
Well, they were the first one to really integrate digital with live interaction. They were the first one to convert a brick and mortar store into an experience store, not yes. only a selling store, which is what, you know, most of the brick and mortars are going to.
So this is another brand that I want to cite as a very good benchmark for looking at the user experience. They have mastered that very well.
What about Marcus being from Goldman Sachs? What's great about that case, what I like, is how they integrated the traditional, the old thinking into the new thinking. That's what I learned from the case. And I feel like that's a type of company that will be successful in launching within all traditional, like you said, banks, insurance. How can you really innovate? How can you become more, more of a customer-driven organization without upending your whole organization?
So Marcus is an interesting case for two reasons. One is Marcus, let me just step back a little bit history-wise. During the last financial crisis, not the one that we are involved now, if you remember, in order for Goldman Sachs, which was not then a commercial bank, in order for Goldman Sachs to receive TARP, basically the relief package at the time, in order for them to receive federal funds, they needed to have a commercial bank license. They did that for that purpose only. Little did they know that was going to be the engine of actually transformation and innovation. So Marcus is a separate entity from Goldman Sachs, branded independently from Goldman Sachs. And it is so for a reason. It is very hard to innovate from within. So oftentimes, organizations who are committed to innovate, to truly transform and challenge their operating model, they actually create outside boxes, if you will. In this case, it's a legal entity that is there for that sole purpose. And Marcus, when you look at it from the outside to the inside, exclusively as a business, you begin to realize, first of all, the profile of people who work there is very different to the profile of people that work in the bank. You have designers, you have a bunch of engineers, you have obviously business people. So you have a multidisciplinary group of folks who are basically trying to create the best for the consumer, irrespective of the fact that Goldman has a high net worth strategy. They have their own strategy. This is something to actually think about when someone is trying to explore how to actually move from where they are today to the new that doesn't exist. They have actually moved into the thing that doesn't exist, to the point that Marcus now is the teaching, if you will, engine for the Goldman Sachs organization.
So for medium and, you know, small-sized financial services companies, do you have a recipe for innovation in that sense? What do you think is the best structure for the team or for, you know, whatever structure or, you know, some banks create their innovation labs, which sometimes they're just marketing sleeps and sometimes they actually work. But what's a recipe for that? What do you think?
So as you know, I've been involved in the early stage space for now a decade, both as an advisor and investor. For the last 3 years, I have been specifically involved in a venture studio. Interestingly enough, is the very first venture studio in Latin America based in Bogota called Polymath Ventures. What the venture studio does is, I mean, we're anyone who is passionate about building companies, building new companies, building new offerings, this is the ideal platform to be able to do it. Because on one hand, you are very focused in basically solving problems. And on the back of solving problems, you create companies that solve those problems. But in order for doing that effectively, you have to do it in a portfolio-based approach, meaning you can't just simply place one singular bet in one thing. The studio gives you the ability to experiment very different ideas at the same time, and you basically go through a process of ideation and experimentation in an agile way, very fast, so that you can learn quickly and then ultimately iterate to create a minimal viable product that then from there you can launch effectively into the marketplace. The studio, and this is true for other studios that are actually growing, precisely in response to your question, the studios are a great outlet for corporations to effectively innovate. I have been involved in innovation projects that are silo-based, that are one-off-based, that are basically one individual sponsoring that thing. In most of these very specific cases that I'm highlighting, the reason why these projects do not succeed is because effectively they lose traction. And oftentimes the organization tries to bring it back to the fore. That is, if you don't have the right governance, if you don't have the right structure to effectively do that, those projects become, you know, totally a failure. Yeah. And the other extension to this example is, well, actually, the way that I'm going to be solving an innovation problem is to go out and buy something. That may prove to be the solution to the problem, but if you don't have the strategy, the framework, the ability to say this actually means that this would allow us to go to market quicker than basically doing it ourselves. This means that this would allow us to integrate or do not integrate at all. This may potentially be a new area of growth for the organization. So those are hopefully, Alejandro, examples of things that have not worked that I think are calls to action for anyone who is thinking about innovating. The last one that I will say is innovation is a journey, is not a destination. So I read recently a stat from Amazon in terms of the numbers of products, and now I'm forgetting the amount of products that they actually launch daily. I may actually get this to you specifically. But it's, I mean, when I heard the number, it was overwhelming. It was higher than the hundreds. I think it was in the thousands. And when I'm saying thousands of products launched daily, That doesn't mean necessarily launching new products. That means you are iterating something, you're adding something, that's a product.
Right.
Okay? And so when you are in the mindset of, I need to be, because this is my DNA, that's what I need to be doing. This is why Amazon is where it is today.
Right. What I hear is that, you know, when you say that, what I hear is, as long as you're focused on finding efficient solutions to problems that you identify, that's innovating. Right? Like 100%. as long as your process is focused on finding solutions, then you're never going to lose traction, because if there is a real problem, then that traction will be behind you.
Yes.
Right?
In fact, when I went to school, I was trained to, whenever I did my go-to-market strategy or a marketing plan or launching a new business, I was trained to look at the marketplace, the addressable marketplace, as a means to say, well, there's so many problems in the marketplace that, you know, it's a trillion or it's a billion, whatever that is. Actually, that's not necessarily the only filter to decide what is it that you need to do. You need to investigate, you need to research enough to validate the problems that you're trying to solve. And then the other question, and again, going back to the studio, the other question is, how are you solving the problem?
Right. Okay.
Oftentimes, people get very, very caught up in, well, if it works here, it must work there. Right? That may prove to be the case in some cases, but that's not entirely true for 100% almost of the cases. So understanding what is the problem that you're solving for, that is what that should be the prerogative for you to design the roadmap to get you to how are you going to be solving that problem.
So why, you know, going back to these into financial services, why do you see financial advisors or wealth managers failing? Who do you see failing in the coming years?
Going back to the client, the industry has, you know, it's the legacy of the model comes on the back of selling new products. Mm. So a lot of the wealth managers, financial advisors, to actually say more generally, financial advisors, by and large, have been occupying most of their attention to talk about the latest investment performance of the moment. They're not entirely at fault, because this is a dual relationship. It is also the client. The client has been trained to think in those terms. Mm-hmm. So
that's a question they ask.
Yes, because that's how the relationship has been established, and so the model has been trained, designed to basically speak about the performance of the portfolio that you have been entrusted to manage. And when you think about for more than a few seconds, you quickly realize that is a daunting task for anyone. You know, forget about you being an expert in the market. How can you hold, say, 20 minutes of conversation to duly and adequately walk the client through the ins and outs of why the portfolio behave in a certain way? I'm not saying that we shouldn't be doing that in earnest. I think there's a space for doing that, but the question is, how are you going to be doing that? Which brings me back to the job of the advisor. And this is industry trends. So what we have seen, and you know this, what we have seen is this evolution from a performance-based model where the advisor is spending bulk of the time around the investment performance of the portfolio to one that is now almost like the primary care physician, if you will. So if you think about the primary care physician here in this country, the job of the primary care physician is to listen to you, hopefully, listen to you, and on the basis of what he's listening from you, he can actually create a diagnosis of what is it that you should be doing. Mm-hmm. And the suggestions from there bring specialties. Maybe you need to do something specific. He will refer you to a specialist to be able to do that. So his job ends there. But you always go back to the primary care physician because he's the generalist who will give you the snapshot and knows you entirely. I think the advisor-client relationship is moving into that sort of relationship model that we see with primary care physicians, where I need to be put in a position, me as an advisor, I need to be put in a position to help you deal with something as incredibly challenging, complex, difficult, that is, how can I create a plan that matches my long-term aspirations, whatever those aspirations may be. And it doesn't have to be when you're 50, it doesn't have to be when you're 40, it doesn't have to be when you're 30. You need to find a way to learn about what is the concept of money. So Varo, for example, an e-money advisor, which is a platform that serves the needs of financial advisors, when you look at these two platforms, they spend a lot of time talking about how can I actually help the end consumer deal with the issue of money. So if you are a millennial, recent graduate, and you are carrying debts of, lots of debt on your shoulder, chances are your ability to save may be marginal. But it is crucially important for that relationship between the advisor and you, for you to understand early enough what is the roadmap that you should be visualizing ahead. Your aspirations continue to be aspirations. You may have short-term goals, but you equally have long-term goals. So that's one cohort. And then the rest of the cohorts, again, what is the plan? Maybe something happened along the way, and now you took a detour in life and now requires a different plan. If you are focused on performance, it's hard to have this type of conversation. Sorry.
Right, because the conversation has always been on performance, because I don't feel like most of the financial advisors in general now, like as you said, generalizing, they don't go into the money conversation because it's hard. It has so much psychology into it. It has so much upbringing into it. It has so much family issues into it that they actually do need to expand their role to be able to do that. They need to, figure out how you're going to really help this person, not just get a better performance, but actually change their behavior with money sometimes. Because totally. It doesn't matter what you do with your performance, if you don't save enough, where are you going, right?
Totally. And to put it even in more perspective, so the largest amount of wealth transfer ever recorded in history is coming in the next 5 to 10 years in this country.
Right.
But it's also around the globe. It's the same here in the US, the same in Europe. Baby boomers to their children.
Right.
This is a big test for the model.
Yeah.
Because the generations that are coming behind the boomers are not, they're not the same.
No, they're very, very different the way they see things. But also they do expect that, that human touch. I always go back to the Betterment example, how they launched online exclusively, no touch, no human touch. Mm-hmm. And then they launched the advisors, which I'm still doubtful about, honestly. I've seen them work. But what that taught me was, okay, yeah, you can go entirely online, but there is so much psychology going into money management that you cannot leave people alone because they're not going to feel the support that they need to feel and the trust they need to feel to continue growing the relationship with you if there is not a human relationship there. Yes. And that's millennials, you know, baby boomers. Millennials come after baby boomers, and that millennials expect that, right?
Totally. I read multiple reports that indicate that when it comes to financial planning, millennials expect to have someone that they can trust to help them design that roadmap. Yes, they also expect a user interface and a client experience that is frictionless, because their expectation as digital natives is so high that will be a total turnoff.
Right. So
the reason why a lot of millennials gravitate to digital tools, you know, the Betterments of the world or the Acorns and Deveros, is precisely for the reason that their expectation from a user interface, user experience, I mean, the bar is so high. They're like, you know, if you're not meeting the basic, why should I even bother?
Right.
But the other piece to that model is they expect equally to have someone that they can trust to be able to design this plan. And this is where, going back to your question, this is where I think this is coming. And by the way, the pandemic, as tragic as it is, you know, when it comes to focusing on the wealth management industry as a whole, you know, this has been a wake-up call for the industry. And I was reading, and again, I think it was yesterday, I was reading that the amount of, oh yeah, I remember, Plaid, the CEO of Plaid, which is this asset aggregator, data aggregator, which was acquired by Visa for $5.3 billion. He was interviewed recently, and the questions were around, talk to us about the growth that you have seen during the pandemic from your clients. And he has a lot of clients, financial services institutions, but equally wealth managers. So he was quoting two things. One was the spike of new openings, new account openings during the pandemic. I mean, he was quoting 50% in 60 days across different types of firms, predominantly those who have a very good digital model.
Right.
But at the same time, he was also seeing the usage of clients in the platform, basically digital models, has equally spiked, meaning people are doing a lot more digitally than they have ever imagined that they would.
Right.
Again, going back to Apple, you can have an Apple card in seconds. You don't need to speak to anyone. You can do the same for a lot of these fintech companies. The models have been designed. And again, the pandemic and the lockdown basically proved the point. These models are quite resilient, and it gravitates all these cohorts of clients to be able to go there. But the need to have someone along the way, meaning a trusted advisor, continues to be there.
Yeah, definitely. And also, like when you say, like picking up the phone, you know, behavior has changed. People don't even want to pick up the phone anymore. So,
totally.
I mean, somebody answered easily. You know,
if you don't have a chat box in your model today, you know, as a wealth manager, hello. I mean, are you serious? This is how it's already being adopted in other sides of the business. When you order an Uber, right. You can, right? So digitalization during the pandemic and post-pandemic is basically forcing these models to evolve.
So tell me something that's true that almost nobody agrees with you on?
Failing.
Okay.
Complaining. So I'll explain. I didn't know then, obviously, when I began to be involved in innovation in earnest, really doing the innovation work and involved in bootstrapping in early stage, you know, I had my own wow moment to basically say, oh, so this is what I've always been a proponent of failing. I never forget my parents gave my brother and I two bikes, motorcycles, motocross bikes, identical, okay? Yamaha 250s. One day, Saturday morning, I just had this incredible urge to know how this incredible machine was built. So I took the entire day, I basically dismantled it. I opened it. And I never forget my mom, who was shouting, looking for me, finally caught up to me. And she, when she went, so this is in the back of the house, and she saw everything on the floor, she could not believe it. She was shouting like, what are you doing? And it actually, so obviously typical mom, well, you have to put it together. It was hard to put it together because obviously I didn't take any notes on the things that I was doing. So I ended up...
No instruction manual, I'm sure.
No instruction manual. It was just, you know, I just wanted to learn. So I learned some things in the process, but I equally learned to fail. And I felt miserably ashamed in front of my parents that I wasn't able to do that. But there's so much associated with failing, and I'm glad that we're slowly getting to accepting failure. Fidelity, for example, from a culture perspective, they expect you to fail. You know, within boundaries, but it's a culture that rewards failure. There are other companies like Amazon that very focused on...
Wait, tell me a little about that. How do you reward failure? Because most companies I've been to and met and worked with, they don't, you know, they say you can try.
Yeah.
Give it a try. But really, how do you actually build into a DNA, hey, you know, into a P&L failure?
So I'll give you a mundane example. So this is in Spain. We actually experimented with a new distribution model and came up with the idea of contacting the largest retailer in the country, and it's one of the largest retailers in Europe. It's called El Corte Inglés. It's a multi-product outlet. It's incredible.
Yeah, the basis of Europe, yeah.
Yes, it's an incredible organization. Privately held, $15 billion. It's incredible organization. They actually created a small unit to help clients, their existing clients, with their financial needs. And so I challenged my team in Spain to basically say, how do we actually help El Corte Inglés and their clients when it comes to assembling financial plans specifically focused on investments, but basically financial plans to help their clients? And we had some products that we had designed recently that were basically asset allocation ready. So they came back with a plan. We actually met with a senior team of El Corte Inglés. I met with the CEO of El Corte Inglés. We had a plan. We brought it back to my boss in the UK. We presented it to the board. But I was very frank. I said, you know, I don't know if this is going to be a success or not. All I do know is this outlet has the largest amount of clients in the entire country. It has an incredible brand. They're present in other parts of Europe, and they basically said, go for it, with the understanding that these, the points of benefit to not only to Fidelity, but equally for the consumers were far superior than the negatives. So we launched this program and we helped El Corte Inglés with what they were looking for. And they were able to embed it within their offering. And that continues to be part of the offering. It wasn't a successful product launch, if you will. It was a successful experiment. And this goes back to the culture. If you're trying to innovate, they reward the process of our experimentation to achieve those innovation efforts. And so that's in that case as an example. Amazon, on the other hand, which was started as a very, very innovative organization, has mastered these and has structured it, institutionalized it throughout the organization. And those press releases that I was mentioning before around new products, daily products, that's the result of having this ingrained institutionalized culture around innovation and failing, rewarding failure. So when you're innovating, you're by definition, you're going to be failing multiple times, but you don't basically slap someone on the hand by failing. You're rewarding because that's part of the ideation process to be able to iterate. So that's on that one.
Closing on, let's close on the topic of innovation. What grade would you give the financial services industry right now in the innovation class?
Ooh, so it's hard to generalize. I mean, the financial services industry is it's a conglomeration of multiple things. I would say, so let me just focus on asset and wealth managers, which is the topic of our conversation today. I think with the exception of few players, there's little innovation taking place. Mm. Very little innovation taking place. There is equally, I would have expected, for example, that as a result of the pandemic, that a lot of these efforts would be more accelerated, but I haven't seen that in true earnest. So, and again, within those two buckets of those two industries, I'm excluding fintechs, which by definition they're already innovating. And even as an example, take PayPal, take Intuit, which are large fintech organizations. They continue to innovate, right?
Touched anything like big that you would say lately? I don't know.
They are innovating. They're innovating. They're innovating fast. And so the asset and wealth management industry, I think they have the work cut out for themselves. Mm-hmm. I continue to say this is an industry like no other that we have seen, ripe for disruption. The need to use data, not only on the investment process, but also in the middle and in the front. It's got the power to, through data analytics, to transform it entirely. Not to mention the speed of adoption in blockchain and digital assets, which is another piece of the innovation. So I'm not going to grade them, as you're asking me, but all I can tell you is they should be doing far more strategically, not on the edges, and really leveraging what we discussed earlier, leveraging what other industries have done, with the Venture Studio, for example, model, which is a great way to innovate.
Thank you so much, Rafael. This has been a lot of fun and very interesting.
Thank you so much, Alejandra. Until the next time.
Until next time.